Guys, it's been a rough year. It's going to get rougher, and you deserve a little treat for not going insane yet. You could head to the local tiki bar and tell the bartender, do your worst. But we have a better idea for you, which is pick out something from the Crooked Store. The store is stocked with tons of new merch. It's perfect for the spring. And classics like the Friend of the Pod tees that you'll be wearing long into the next administration or the next fascist dictatorship, depending on how things go. Pick up a new tee for the warm weather ahead, a mug that'll remind you to stay involved this election year, or a hat celebrating your favorite pod. Go to crooked.com/store to shop.
And we're back with an all-new episode of Keep It.
Morning.
I'm Ira Madison III.
I'm Louis Fertel.
I'm Aida Osman. I'm sorry for interrupting both of your guys' introductions.
I'm going to say, you're like Mystery Science Theater 3000, piping in with your jokes too early. I want to apologize to people, by the way, if I sound echoey this episode. I'm in my new place. I haven't figured it out yet. I'm doing my best. I'm in tears, etc. I haven't even combed my hair. I look like a 34-year-old ragamuffin.
Lewis is in a cave.
Aida is recording on the floor next to her front door.
Yeah, it looks like I'm in a tenement. You have to be very careful.
You also just moved.
We all did. It's so nice. I want a chair.
I didn't just move. I'm in a hotel right now.
Oh, yeah. And it's what time for you then?
It's afternoon, baby. I got my workout in. I had my coffee. I had breakfast.
It's an advantage. It really, truly is.
No, I associate Record and Keep It with like being like I live in a monastery and we do this before the morning prayer, etc.
Yeah, and now they want you to have a rave. Right. Yeah, I have to slap myself a couple times before I can have an opinion.
Truly, Aida, you missed the very early days of this show where I feel like we used to record at 8 a.m.
Oh, God.
And all three of us showing up to the studio looking angry.
And also, by the way, in those days, we had people filming us for different reasons. And so we would also have to be in like chic outfits. I would be wearing a blazer at 7:30 a.m. Like I'm Al Roker. Yeah.
Last week, I feel like we were a little too nice.
Yeah, we were.
To whom?
Everybody.
Oh, that's right.
Our list of 150 things that didn't suck. I feel like this week we will be more than making up for it.
Yeah. Because I'm ready to cut some bitches. I'm ready. I got
the whiplash this week of everything becoming awful again.
1,500 things that really suck. Yeah.
So why don't we go ahead and get into this episode? We're going to talk about the Tony nominations. We're going to talk about Jeffrey Toobin's Zoom fiasco. We're going to get into the culture we've been consuming this week. And we will also be joined by Gabrielle Union.
Queen of Queens. My God, what a keep it get. We've wanted this for years.
Yeah.
This is going to be the most aggressively Nebraskan episode of podcast history. Easily. Easily. Alexander Payne is going to lose what little is left of his mind.
The ghost of Johnny Carson showing up.
Yeah.
All right. We'll be right back with more Keep It. And we're back. Before we get into what we've been consuming this week, there's, of course, the business of the Tony Awards, which are finally happening.
Great.
How long do they get put off?
They usually happen in June.
They are usually the same weekend as Pride in LA, which is very stressful because routinely that morning I will be at a parade or something, and then in the afternoon I'm at a party, and then you have to race home to watch Alan Cumming do his three jokes. And then there's like a concert at night, and I'm like, well, now I have to deal with Carly Rae. So
this year, they will be digital. I think that probably after a large amount of award shows going that route, the Tonys were like, hey, we can do that too, even if we're theater.
Right. Anything you can do, I can do better, if you will.
And the nominations are... there's some fun surprises in there. I will say I'm very happy for Jeremy O'Harris with 12 nominations.
Breaking
for
records.
Slave Play.
Breaking literal
that
records.
That is a record.
Yeah, girl.
It is like the upshot of a season that was cut short is that everything that was nominated almost with no choice has to break records. Like Jagged Little Pill, you would think is basically a chorus line based on the amount of nominations it just received.
15. But congrats to Diablo. Anna Linus.
Yes. Especially, I mean, congrats to Diablo. She's our friend. Hooray. Yes to Alanis. I love late stage Alanis getting some recognition. I love her albums after Jagged Little Pill almost as much as I love Jagged Little Pill. So I'm excited for this recognition. And by the way, the best book of a musical, Tony, that to me is one of the most interesting categories because aside from the fact it's three jukebox musicals, which we can talk about the state of musicals right now another time. But we've got Diablo Cody for Jagged Little Pill, John Logan for Moulin Rouge, and then Katori Hall, who came on a few weeks ago to talk about P-Valley on Stars, who wrote Tina, the Tina Turner musical. And I really don't know who's going to win that category. It's exciting.
Mm-hmm. I absolutely fucking loved Tina, and I'm so excited for Adrian Warren's nomination for that. All of the Moulin Rouge nominations, sure. Well, I'm just going to say that is truly one of the most horrible shows that I have ever seen on Broadway.
I know. I concur. Frankly, after I heard the nominations, I listened to a lot of Broadway SiriusXM radio. I don't want to brag. But Aaron Tveit, who is the only Best Actor in a Musical nomination this year, after the nominations occurred, I listened to him sing Roxanne. Who the fuck wants to hear Roxanne jazzed up like that? I mean, I don't even like it in Moulin Rouge, the movie. So to hear it, like, totally stripped of the, like, white reggae vibe that we tolerated in the 70s, I don't know.
I feel like that's the best part of the movie.
Aaron's the only one in the category?
Correct.
What if he doesn't win? Does he have to actually get...
Yeah, he could lose.
He could lose. Doesn't he have to get, like, a percentage of everyone who's voting for the Tonys to... even get him the award, like
60%.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh no.
It's kind of gladiatorial. It's either a thumbs up or a thumbs down from voters. Yeah.
I want to know what happens in that occasion. Do you just not present the award?
You skip right along by it.
Since he's the only one. Or do you say, and the winner is and then it's like when Tyra would hold up no photo. The girl who's going home is both of you.
And Aaron has to sulk his way home and tweet at his Tvader tots. Is that what his fan base is called? Do you guys know about this?
Tvader tots? Are they?
Yes. Yes, yes.
Oh,
it's a very small,
disgusting,
insular group. No, it's really, really gross. It's really bad.
Aaron Tveit is the classic Broadway musical actor in that he is every age. If you told me he was 54 or 21, I would totally believe it. In the way that, like, prima ballerinas, you know, are secretly in their sick. Like, Misty Copeland, I think, died 40 years ago, you know?
He also manages to be every nationality of European. Like, I couldn't peg that man in any way. German features? Scandinavian eyebrows? Don't know.
Unfortunately, he's also been in two of the absolute worst Broadway musicals I've ever seen. One was Moulin Rouge, which I definitely should not have gone to see with our friend Matt Whitaker after we were out at a party until 4 a.m.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I know how you operate.
The next day, hungover. And the other one was he was in the musical version of Catch Me If You Can.
Oh.
Which I left during intermission.
Was he the, what's that character's name? I can't believe I can't think of it. He was on To Tell the Truth once. Was he the main guy?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Such great outfits in the movie, though. And the last time I enjoyed Christopher Walken, who's in... Wait, Christopher Walken is in Catch Me If You Can, right?
Yeah, I believe so. Everyone in the musical looked like they were in the ABC show Pan Am.
Ah, yes.
And that just seemed to be the entire concept for the show.
I do love that shade of blue, though. The same blue as what Britney wears in the Toxic video, for those of you who are under-initiated.
Yes. The same song that Karen Olivo sings in Moulin Rouge.
Mm. Right, right, right.
Because the songs in Moulin Rouge, the musical, aren't even the songs from the movie. They update it with newer songs. Like, you have her singing Firework.
I have to tell you, ever since that Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt episode where they complain about how the word firework doesn't make sense on its own, the phrase is fireworks, I cannot even listen to that song. I'm like, you're wrong, Katie. Get a dictionary.
Of course, these nominations come on the heels of 40 Black playwrights issuing a screed to the theater industry, basically calling out racism in the theater. And I mean, it makes sense. There's not really a lot of diversity going on here. It's except for Slave Play and Tina.
Right. Well, also, it almost makes sense to me that of all the forms of entertainment beyond movies and TV, it almost makes sense to me that Broadway would be perhaps the most racist because there's the most gatekeeping going on. Like, only a certain amount of spaces exist. Only a certain amount of plays get produced. Like, there's layers upon layers, you know, that add up that... If you're going to insert racism anywhere, it's going to be in one of those places.
And in conjunction with that, one of the people who was involved in this statement was Rada Blake, who, you know, just had this film, The 40-Year-Old Virgin, which debuted on Netflix recently. And it's about her struggles with being a black playwright and, you know, trying to navigate her way through this gatekeeping, you know, and try to tell authentic stories that didn't feel like she was being a sellout. And that really seems like, you know, so much of the problem, because unlike film, unlike television, you are catering to an audience of rich white people, basically, right?
Mm-hmm.
And white producers. And even if you're a black person making black content, you better be making something black that will appeal to white people on the Upper West and Upper East Side.
Right. I mean, if you're making an all black ensemble musical or play or whatever, and one of the main objectives ends up having to be, but the white audience has to feel good. I mean, you're already compromising not just division, but like any reason anybody would want to make something.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's just, you know, and that was so evident in some of the testimonials we read there. For instance, Lynn Nottage, who's won two Pulitzers, she was one of the people who gave really excellent and startling and incisive feedback.
Also, what a shame to imply that white people can only muster being empathetic if they see their faces in the art that they're admiring or watching. Like, that's a frustrating thing. And that actually plays out in a scene in the movie in 40-Year-Old Virgin, which is an interesting watch.
It's basically autobiographical. She's playing herself, and she's writing a play about gentrification in Harlem, and the white producer is like, well, we need to see that from the white people's side, too.
Who is doing the gentrifying? We'd love to see it.
And then it ends basically, you know, with like the white woman and the black woman having to come to an understanding. We're all in this together, because it's the corporations who are buying out the coffee shops and things who are part of the problem, not the white people who are living there.
We're simply angels.
Sorry, I'm tearing up. You guys really inspired me just now.
And there's, you know, a lot of other playwrights involved, you know, like Robert O'Hara. He wrote the plays Booty Candy and Barbecue, which I love. He directed Slave Play, actually, and mm-hmm. he is nominated for Best Director. You know, he talks about how in Portland, like an artistic director tells him, like, I love your work, you know, I just don't have the courage to do it.
Wow.
You know, and there's this idea that you love someone's work so much, but you're like, I can't lose money on this investment. And I think that that is why a digital Tonys is so interesting to me. And it's so interesting. I plan to watch two plays later this week, actually, that Jeremy O'Harris is actually producing. He's producing a showing of Heroes of the Fourth Turning, which is a Pulitzer finalist play from the same year as Slave Play last year, except it was off-Broadway, and it is by Will Arbery. He's also doing this play called Circle Jerk, which is playing all this week, and that is like a digital play, basically. You know, it's trying to do theater in the current space-time we're living in during a pandemic, you know, and it is... I hope things like this are successful. You know, I mean, I mm-hmm. spent the beginning of the pandemic watching Andrew Lloyd Webber musicals that were streaming each week.
When they were throwing them in our face.
Yeah, well, they were doing one each week. And, you know, I watched like Phantom of the Opera. I even watched that abysmal show, Love Never Dies, which has one good song till I hear you sing in it. And, you know, I just think that like embracing the future is the only way that we're going to be able to break through that theater gatekeeping, you know?
Totally. But also, by the way, I just want to say, we were talking about the nominations earlier. I mean, savor what theater you get digitally, because, for instance, we're going to have the Tonys this year, but we will definitely not have them next year. So we're about to be going through a real dearth in this kind of entertainment. So we've got mm-hmm. to find new and innovative ways of not just producing it, but snatching it up, keeping it in, you know, sharing it with people who are going to give a shit.
And also, what a pleasure it is to get to see some like actual digital theater instead of like whatever Ivo Van Hove does whenever he does a production. I didn't get to see the newer West Side Story, but I know that it has like stuff projected like onto the wall behind the actors.
Right.
I don't know how that works in West Side Story, but I do know that it was awful in his production of All About Eve that I saw in the West End.
Oh, wait, you saw that one with Gillian Anderson and
Lily James.
Correct. And with the music of PJ Harvey, who's one of my patron saints. Was that not good?
Oh, it was awful.
I can't believe we've never discussed that. That's like, I mean, that truly is like every chakra in my body is in that. All About Eve, Gillian Anderson, PJ Harvey.
I also felt gaslit watching it because the entire time I kept thinking, wait, was All About Eve a play?
And it wasn't.
And then I was like, oh no, it was adapted from a movie into a play. I was like, I knew that, but somehow I was tricked into thinking that because when you see a play of something that was, you know, not a musical, you think that, oh, it was originally a play or something. You think it was adapted.
And also, it kind of feels like it could have been a play. It's not like chock full of locations or anything. You know?
Yeah. Unfortunately, it cannot be a play.
Damn it, still love Gillian. Yeah. She's great on Sex Education. I've only
I love
seen three
her.
Episodes,
you know?
But those three episodes are great.
And Lily James is great in those paparazzi photos with Dominic West.
I was like, this can't be a compliment coming up. Okay.
I like Mamma Mia.
Sure. Yeah.
Okay. Now that I'm done attacking beloved white actors, what else have we been consuming this week?
Well, I don't know if you guys saw this, but I feel like we can collectively make fun of it. The Let Me Love You Like a Woman music video that Lana Del Rey dropped on the internet where she's making love to her steering wheel. I don't know if you guys have seen this, but it is an interesting music video where she's, I mean, everyone is struggling to figure out how to make quarantine art pop right now. And she has taken like parsed together little clips of her on road trips and, you know, just on tour with her friends and family. But there's particularly like this weird B-roll of her singing like romantically into the camera while she hugs and kind of kisses on her steering wheel. And if anybody wants a laugh and doesn't quite know what's happening with Lana Del Rey, which who does, that's interesting. That's an interesting thing to watch.
You know what I am still sore with her about? Okay, so I forgive her for the clapping back at the critics who she disagreed with or whatever, except for the fact that she said something along the lines of, I don't have a persona, I've never needed one. One, you are so almost nothing but a persona. And I say that affectionately. I love personae. We all have one, you know? And it should be embraced. But that was such a fascinating reveal about what she thought she was. And it trips me up. It was so, I don't want to say delusional, but it was so bitter and annoying. It's always tainted her a little bit for me.
Maybe she like was playing the part of Lana Del Rey and then actually became Lana Del Rey. Like she's trapped in Lana Del Rey and now she thinks there is no persona.
Well, that's interesting that you say that because do you know what I finally watched over the weekend is the, I think it's 2019 officially now, the Dolly Parton documentary that's on Netflix, which has some good talking heads from our girl Jane Fonda's in it. Kylie Minogue is in it. Yes. But Lily Tomlin gives interviews in it where she's like, I don't want to say cutting into Dolly Parton. She's clearly friends with her, but really insightful things about her. Like she says, like, I don't really know anything about her. It's like she doesn't give anything up. And she goes, I've never seen her without a wig. And there's somebody else. Oh, I think Linda Perry from Four Non Blondes, famous top hat wearer. You might mistake her for the lead singer from Jamiroquai sometimes.
Famous writer of Pink songs.
Yes, and Christina Aguilera songs, yes.
Yes.
She goes, I think there are two different Dollies, and like they're in conversation all the time. Lana Del Rey seems like a sort of similar situation, though maybe she is in denial about it.
Well, she's literally operating under a pseudonym. You're using a name. How can you not acknowledge it's a persona?
Right. Good point.
Girl.
That reminds me of how, obviously, Lily Tomlin and Jane Fonda are friends, but do you remember like Lily's talking head from Jane's documentary too?
Oh yeah, right. Like,
she is truly just the most insightful / shadiest talking head that you could get.
Right. No, she's, I mean, like when you're like a no-nonsense lesbian who's been in a relationship 30 years, I mean, like, I think you're pretty clear what you don't have time for, and that's not cutting to the quick. Yeah.
I would recommend if you have any free time to just watch YouTube videos of Jane Fonda and Lily Tomlin interacting. They have the most endearing but like biting relationship, and it's fun. It's a fun time.
This week, I finally dove into the Amazon show, The Boys.
Ooh.
Still haven't seen.
Meaning to start.
Well, first of all, two seasons have aired, and I don't know how I really, like, missed this show, but I feel like I'm a Gossip Girl fan. I knew Chase Crawford was in it, and I was like, well, I don't need to see him, quote-unquote, act. And so that's how I avoided it. And it was like, I was like, oh, it's an Amazon show about, like, superheroes, whatever. Because I had never really read the Garth Ennis comic that it was based on, even though, you know, like, I was a fan of Preacher and stuff. But first of all, he's fantastic in it. I don't know where this acting came from. It's sort of like the same way that Penn Badgley had such an amazing turn in You, mm-hmm. that Chase Crawford does the same thing. And basically, the conceit of The Boys is that, like, superheroes are real, but they're managed by, like, Vought, like a company that's basically like CAA or something, you mm-hmm. know? And so, like, they manage their image, and there's a group called The Seven, which are the most famous superheroes, and, you know, they get the endorsement deals, and they're in movies, they act in them themselves, you know? And it's like, basically, The Boys are this group of people who are trying to take down Vought and the superheroes, because the superheroes sort of, like, behave with impunity mm-hmm. all the time. Like, it starts with... Jack Quaid is the lead of the show, by the way, who it took me forever to realize that this boy is not British doing a bad American accent, because Simon Pegg plays his father in the show, and he looks British, but now I realize, oh, you just look like a mix of Meg Ryan and Dennis Quaid. his girlfriend gets run through by A-Train, like, who's like the speedster of the Seven. You know, and like they basically like sweep it under the rug and everything. And this becomes like superheroes are bad and need to be brought down. And there's some fantastic, amazing performances in it. And Chase Crawford plays like a superhero who sexually assaults one of the other ones and then is fired from the group. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of about him like trying to like fix his image and like get back into the group and then not really. And it's like, it's sort of one of the most honest depictions of like a quote unquote famous person who does something awful like that and how they would try to worm their way back into society and back into, you know, their endorsement deals and things and not being able to do it and finding religion and things. And I just think that it's a really good show. It's very funny. It's good when it's satirical. It's mm-hmm. not good when it tries to be serious.
Does it paint Chase Crawford's character as a villain, or is he actually someone that we feel for?
Both.
I'm excited to have an opinion about him. I mean, frankly, he's somebody who you just was like a celebrity you'd see walking down the street on like PerezHilton.com once upon a time.
Yeah.
And that was as far as any thoughts I had about him go. I love when we take somebody like that and then they get to do something unusual and prove something. Like, you know how Robert Pattinson sort of gotten 25 times to do it? And to be fair, he has done it. I like when that's spread around.
I feel like Good Times was the final nail in the coffin for me. But yeah. I was very excited to start watching this show. It does remind me a lot of the anime My Hero Academia, which, if you guys aren't familiar, mm-hmm. is like, remember when Meg Thee Stallion did her half white, half red wig? She was doing Todoroki from My Hero Academia. And My Hero Academia has the same premise that, you know, there's a training school. I mean, it's like the younger version. It's like the Rugrats to the grown-ups, if the grown-ups is the boys. And so these kids have to train in these institutions, and they get sponsored, and it is, like you said, like a WME or a CAA, and they get all these different sponsorships. I'm excited to see where the parallels are.
Yeah, I think you'll like it. I mean, I truly love when people from teen shows, you know, get sort of like a second act.
Yeah.
I love when people are known for like two very good roles. It shows that they can sort of do something. And I would recommend that people watch also the Actors Roundtable, where Penn Badgley and Chase Crawford sort of interview each other. Because, like, it gave me new insight into, like, Chase as a human being. Really enjoy the show, though, you know? I would say one downside of it is that the second season dives so well into, like, internet culture and like right-wing, like conservative, like 4chan kind of shit.
Oh, wow.
And in such a good, searing way. But they do need some more writers of color on the show. Because the black character stuff is just goofy.
Yeah, The Boys.
But otherwise, very funny show.
Also, you know what that means? Ed Westwick, you better figure out what you're doing, because these boys are running amok.
Well, wasn't he accused of rape?
What?
Right. No, he's one of those people that went away for He also, I believe among British men, and this is a serious feat, he has the worst tattoos I have ever seen. Because all they like doing is getting shitty tattoos over there. So.
I know. I've seen Love Island.
Yeah, right. By the way, sorry, have we talked about Emily in Paris yet?
I mean, it was my keep it, but go ahead.
Yeah.
I
will just touch on it really quickly. It's a show that I just want to say it is remarkable how the episodes slip by, regardless of what you think about it. And I believe it can drive you to homicide. So it's really shocking. But what's weird to me about Emily in Paris that no one is saying is her performance is so strange, Lily Collins. And I've diagnosed it. It's like she's in the opening credits of Sex and the City. It's not even like she's on the show. It's like she's walking through a montage is her whole take on the character. And in order for you to root for her, the villains have to be so grotesquely mean and or stupid in order for it to work. Now I'm sympathetic to those characters for that reason, but I honestly thought the weird thing no one was talking about is how the female villain is joylessly cruel. That's, to me, the problem.
I started to love Sylvie by the end of the series, though.
Okay, because
this is a French woman who just wants to have sex all the time and, like, smoke and, like, love sexual harassment because that is what the French do, you know? and you're right, Lily Collins is just, you know, like, plucking her way through the show, conflict-free, stumbling into mayhaps.
Lewis, I'm surprised you watched it. I really am, because I feel like after this onslaught of a literal barrage of this show fucking sucks for you to go and watch it. And any enjoyment at all? Anything that you could...
Well, I guess, in all honesty, I would have to say I did look at it and continued to look at it. So I guess some sort of endorphin was sparked in me, I'm sorry to say.
It's truly a show that had to be dropped on Netflix. I could not, like Younger, which is actually good, I could not conceivably watch Emily in Paris week to week. The fact that it's just there and you can press play and it keeps going and the episodes themselves don't even really conclude. Like, they just sort of, like, the credits roll, and then all of a sudden you're in a new episode.
Right. It's like, think of that new campaign where Ryan Murphy is bragging about how 48 million people at least tuned in to Ratched. And I feel like that show is the same way. They just make it so appealing and aesthetic that you sort of leave it on. Like, I want to learn more about the science of leaving on TV, which I feel like Netflix has tapped into.
The absent watch.
Yes.
I'll leave us with a positive thing about Lily Collins. Do you remember the coffee bean from West Hollywood? R.I.P. The one next to Jim Bar, also R.I.P. Mm-hmm. She used to come in every winter to get the Winter Dream tea latte. And she was always very pleasant.
How you just put her drink order out like that?
Very pleasant, unlike Michelle Trachtenberg.
Oh.
Lily in L.A.
Yeah. All right. When we're back, we'll be joined by Gabrielle Union. Black Stories, Black Truths is a celebration of blackness from NPR and how I live my life every day.
Oh, I'm glad to bear witness to it.
Each of NPR's black voices are as distinct, varied, and nuanced as the black experience itself. In the Black Stories, Black Truths collection, you'll hear stories of joy, resilience, empowerment, and creating world-shifting things out of a struggle.
It sounds like you at Coachella. I'm already tuned in. Every episode is a living account about what it means to be black today, told from a unique black perspective, from Bobby Shmurda to The Wire, Michelle Obama to reparations. There's no limit to the range of black stories, black truths.
Black perspectives haven't always been centered in the telling of America's story. Now they are the story. In NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, you'll find a collection of some of NPR's best podcast episodes celebrating the black experience. Hear a feed of episodes from across NPR's podcasts that center black voices. It's NPR Noir. Turn on NPR today and hear a range of voices as very nuanced and black as the country we reflect. Stories should never be about us without us.
Doesn't the black experience sound like a 3-disc Prince album we never got? Someone check the vault, please. Listen now to Black Stories, Black Truths from NPR, wherever you get your podcasts.
We are very excited to have Gabrielle Union on the show. You have been a guest we've wanted on the show for our past 150 episodes.
Yes.
And now you're on 151.
Welcome.
Yes, not just an amazing actress, but not even a businesswoman. You are a business woman.
Oh. That sounds better than the way I say it. But yeah, I'll take it.
I'm going to let Aida start this off because Aida has been telling us constantly that she is so excited to have a Nebraskan on the show.
That's it. No, this episode is going to be so Nebraskan. It's going to be like Tom Osborne eating a runza at the Henry Dorley Zoo. Like, that's it.
That's
the
Nebraska truck.
I know.
What talking about right now and why I'm
so only excited. Two people are going to be Wait. So happy about that joke. When Gabrielle Union comes back to Nebraska, don't let her come back because it's in the news cycle. She could come in October and it's still in the news cycle like New Year's. Like, it's such a big deal when Gabrielle comes back. I've been to one college football game and it was to watch Gabrielle watch football. That's my sport.
What?
Like, that was, yeah. Yes, yeah, no. Not a football fan, but I am a fan of you and your husband, so.
Oh my God. Wait, so you went to Nebraska, University of Nebraska, mm-hmm. and did not mm-hmm. go to any games?
No. I only went to one.
How?
Do you know how difficult it is to escape that culture? I was living under a rock.
Okay, so now I need to know what dorm you were in.
I wasn't in a dorm.
Oh, because
I stayed home.
From Lincoln.
I'm from Lincoln. Yeah, I stayed. That's probably why. I was like off campus and reading a lot and was like, no college football. But, you know, I went to all the tailgates, if that makes you feel any better.
Okay, so we do the tailgate through this crew called the Varsity, and we're under mm-hmm. the freeway.
Yep, I know exactly.
And we do shot skis and like Flip Cup. We are the 2019 Flip Cup champions.
Oh, wow.
We have those photos also in our house next to Dwayne's NBA championships because it meant that much to us.
Athletes, yes.
All kinds of athletics we excel at over here.
Sorry that we're going off about football. Even though I'm not a part of it, I can recognize that Nebraska fans are just wild. Like the Sea of Red, we have one of the largest fan bases in the world, I will easily say. So it's just, it's a very intense experience. That's why we are so excited, dear listeners.
No, it's a whole thing. I will follow someone on the freeway with a Nebraska plate just to pull alongside them to go Big Red! And they're always equally as excited, no matter what. They have a gun rack in the back. It doesn't matter. They'll be like, yeah, I'm still problematic, but yeah.
Speaking of you and Dwayne, I feel like y'all have had, in the midst of 2020 being a mess, y'all have at least had a great year for, you know, just like being visible and being like great examples of one, parents, and two, just like Black people who are famous but not going crazy.
Not like that we've done
lately. Yes. At least not being like, we're rich and we want to support Trump. So, you know, not going that route. I just want to know, like, how it is to stay, like, grounded and also to just, like, put yourselves out there. Like, you just were on the cover of Time, too, you know? Like, put yourselves out there as, like, parents who are now being seen as just, like, an example of how to parent, you know, especially with your, you know, embracing Zaya, and then just having that embracement of the LGBTQ community for you two as parents.
Yeah, it's always bizarre to be acknowledged for doing like the bare ass minimum, which is like loving your kids exactly as they are. Mm-hmm. So that's always a little odd. But when you realize that there's a lot of parents who just don't, who like believe that their children are disposable or inherently unlovable, you know, we understand the role that we have and the platform that we have and loving out loud and unapologetically Black and loving out loud. And I'm speaking up about all kinds of things. I would hope that I'm not alone in this. A lot of people do it. I just don't think people take as much glee to battle the fuckery that we do. So maybe that's the difference. Like, I just, it fuckery gives me the hives. I can't sit in the fuck shit. I can't do it. Not anymore. Cause I did it. I'm not going to say I didn't do it. I sat in it. I like dipped my crackers in it. I ate it up. But then you get to a point where, I don't know, going along to get along doesn't work and doesn't feed your soul and it doesn't allow you to sleep at night. And I don't know, I don't want to have to deal with anything that affects my joy, my peace, or my grace, mine or anybody else's. So I'm gonna keep talking my shit, and especially when it helps the greater good. And pay, like, it's okay to like pay your fucking taxes when you're a bazillionaire. why are you pressed about money that actually helps the people that you're trying to exploit? I don't exactly understand that. To me, when somebody shows you who they are and their disdain for Black women, that's when I jump off the fandom. When you reject or malign Black women, which a lot of these dudes have that are suddenly pro-Trump, you lost me a long time ago. This wasn't the straw that broke the camel's back. Like, you know what I mean? Like, when you attack the very Black woman that leads your cast on your very successful show, I don't know what else we needed to see, how many more opportunities we needed to give before we got to this shock and awe that we have right now. I don't even know why it takes so long for people to understand the damage and harm caused when we start with Black women as your target. Mm-hmm. Like, why do we have to keep
giving people? That's always the tell.
Yeah, why do we have to keep giving people opportunities to harm Black women before we're like, what? You're like, bitch, you knew, you thought it. You just don't care about us. How about you just say you don't care about Black women and stop acting so shocked by more bad behavior?
Yeah.
I'm cool on that.
Other than us being two Black women from Nebraska, that has already been such a connecting point for when I've been following your career since, I don't know, birth, like for a long time. And oddly, these things would happen where I was experiencing something in my life and it would match up with a Gabrielle Union story in the news. Like, what was happening with your work experience at America's Got Talent reminded me that there were no safeguards for Black women, regardless of what level of career that you were at. And I was experiencing something on a much smaller scale, but in my own work environment at the same time. So as a Black woman, like, what do you do to protect your energy when you learn those hard truths that, like, nowhere is safe?
For me and the crew, we've had to find our own safe space. And before we were calling it safe spaces, it was finding people in the community, sometimes where you least expect it, doing your own due diligence about who somebody is and not kind of going with what the popular opinion of somebody is, and finding those safe spaces and creating them yourself. And it might only be 5 minutes a day on a group chat, especially now with COVID. But like, we used to have like meetups where we called them long drunken lunches that sometimes turned into even longer drunken dinners, where we just had a chance to just vomit our emotions and all the things that we experienced during the week that we weren't safe enough to talk about openly. Cause you just, you know, those bills needed to be paid. The bank is so weird about wanting their money every month. you needed that safe space and that strong cocktail to just vent with other people who see you and hear you and aren't gonna try to explain away your trauma and the harm that you've been experiencing. For the most part, safe spaces amongst within our community and randomly a bomb ass ally.
I feel like I have a photographic memory for celebrities who give great interviews. And so you always come to mind, like if it's a video soundbite or I'm reading something, like I can always depend on it. One, usually being funny, but two, like just super thoughtful. And I was thinking, a few years ago, you wrote a memoir, and you're the exact type of celebrity I always want to write a memoir, where I'm like, we only got to hear her speak for 5 minutes in this interview. Please go off for 300 pages. What was that experience like for you? Did you gain anything from having written a memoir?
The process of writing it was exhilarating and they're very therapeutic. But the process of handing over some of your deepest, darkest secrets to the world is literally, it really does feel like tossing your baby into a crowd and hoping people catch it. and don't like abuse your baby. Yeah, for the most part, people were like, oh my God, look at this baby. This is such a sweet baby. And then some people drop kick my baby and, you know, you know, I don't know. So it's, you want people to have a positive takeaway from your words. You know what I mean? I'm a lover of words. I love word games. I love books. I'm special in that way. So you want people to appreciate your words, but at the same time, I don't know. It's a it's a trust thing with your readers that you hope they see you and get you and maybe understand you and hopefully also provide some community. Because I try to discuss things that have been taboo or, you know, those, oh, I couldn't possibly. And I'm like, yeah, I didn't know my pussy from my urethra. Like, didn't know. didn't think to go beyond my clitoris. Like, what for? Seemed like all the fun was there. But like in writing that, having people, you know, read it and then doing interviews about it, people were like, okay, I thought it was just me not knowing where to put a tampon. Like it sparked like larger conversations about sex and fertility journeys and aging and dating and marriage and all sorts of things. So now that I'm writing the follow-up and my first draft is due in about a month and a half, it's that panic of the purge. Like I've purged even more shit, including chapters that I wasn't quite ready to include in the first book. But I thought I've had enough therapy and guided meditations to deal with giving to the world. I don't know. We'll see. We'll see in the final when, like by next fall, when you see the finished work, what I was strong enough to include. Because there's nothing I hate more than reading somebody's biography or, you know, something super personal and then watching their interviews and they're like, well, I don't read the book. Well, bitch, I read the fucking book and now I want to know. I want to talk more about it. You're not like, healed enough or cool enough to like talk about, you know, some of these larger issues that you bring up, like what was the point? So I want to do more than just titillate with my words or stories. And I want to inspire real community and real deeper conversation. So hopefully I'm able to do that with this next one, like the first one.
Fuck yes.
Speaking of your memoir, We're Going to Need More Wine, there is a segment in it where you talk about being the black girl at school, you know, like when you were younger, like all these white girls, the chip in the cookie, a phrase I know you love. Mm-hmm. There's a moment where you talk about how y'all used to play Days of Our Lives. And you know I watched that show still. And now you talked about how it was in the 90s before Lexi had even joined as like the female cop. So you always had to play old Abe, the black police detective. Who did you want to play the most?
Hope. Are you kidding me? Hope.
Okay. You wanted Hope. To play Hope.
Yes. I did not want to be Marlena. I would have rather been like John Black 2.0 than Abe, the policeman with no storyline. But no, I wanted to be
still
Hope.
Has no storyline, by the way.
Still no
storyline.
It's a damn shame. That's a damn shame. I wanted to be Hope with my bow and yeah.
Mm-hmm. Princess Gina and everything. I get it.
I want to be kidnapped by Stefano. Give me something. Never met
me. Speaking being a chip in the cookie, which I'm stealing now, that's mine now too. There's something I try to explain to people about being a queer person who grew up in the Midwest. It's such an isolated, deeply lonely, but also really formative experience. And you wrote a children's book for your daughter, Welcome to the Party.
Yeah.
But I use it and apply it to my own life as if, you know, I'm actually starting these conversations about what different families could look like and how finding a queer community and like the concept of a chosen family, really, like the people that I have invited into my life as a queer person, because sometimes my family, my birth family, doesn't necessarily give me everything I need. So I want to ask you, what other than, you know, inviting a wonderful person into your family, what inspired you to write that book?
Just not seeing a lot about surrogacy, you know what I mean? Children's books about surrogacy or introducing a family member that did not come through someone's uterus, like the mother's, like her, like me. So this idea of a child arriving that is wanted and desired and loved, but just didn't come through, you know, the traditional way. So that was my original, inspiration. But then Zaya was like, oh, is this about me? And I was like, well, you know what? It is about you. As Zaya says, you know, like, I've come out like three times, and each time it's like I'm reborn and I'm introducing myself. And I was like, word, yep, facts. And then, you know, my mom was like, oh, is this about my kids? And I was like, yep. So my mom at 60, being the nice Nebraska Catholic woman that she is, adopted her first child at 60, her second at 61, and her third at 64. And so now my mom has three kids, two teens and a preteen. There was nothing about adoption, like, of Black children, which is super common, you know, maybe not officially adopting Black children in our families, but incorporating children from our larger family into our immediate family. And I was like, yep, mom, this book is about yep, y'all too. My original inspiration just kind of grew by the time it actually sat on shelves. It was about anybody who arrived at their family through non-traditional ways. Yeah, so because I heard a lot about chosen families and feeling like you're just arriving to a party as your full self and what that feels like even when it doesn't happen until your 40s or 50s. I probably heard most from older queer folks who came out much, much, much later and faced just a lot of rejection from their birth families and finally found themselves and their community in their chosen families. And, you know, sometimes you write something that has one intention and it just grows. So I'm glad that so many different kinds of people embrace the story and the idea of there's all different ways to family and there's no one way. All of the ways are beautiful and real and valid and worthy of celebration.
When I look over your filmography, something that is so exciting to me is you have so many, even early in your career, movies that were beloved at the time that only gain in legacy as the years go on. Like Bring It On and Love and Basketball, these will never go away. These are like part of our lives forever and ever. And I was just wondering, what are your like favorite ways in which these movies that are now 20 years old live on in your life?
Well, I mean, some of them are just friendships, you know? So like Deliver Us From Eva, I did that with my best friends and they've stayed my best friends, you know, for shit, the last 20 some odd years. Love and Basketball, shot that with, you know, strangers and who then became, you know, very, very close friends. But Bring It On, the best way that I see Bring It On celebrated every year, never gets old, always exciting, is Halloween. This time of year where the Clover costumes are in full effect and everyone tags me. And every time, every post gets me so excited. You know, we in the original, you know, script and in what we actually shot, we're in it like a third of the film. But what actually happened was when they started showing Bring It On to test audiences, the reaction was we need more of the Clovers. But by that time, it was too late because we'd already finished the movie. So we shot additional footage for the trailer that was not in the movie to fool people into thinking that we were in it like 50-50, like it was actually. Like,
so that's what happened.
Yeah.
Now, listen, I have told you that is like truly maybe my favorite movie. It's the one I watched the most. I even hosted that screening of it in Toronto last year. I have constantly watched that trailer and been like, did they cut the Clovers from this movie? There's scenes with you like kissing like a boy by a locker. There's other scenes where it's like, oh, they're just hanging out at school. I was like, where are the scenes?
In the trailer.
It was a scam.
No, we ran a full scam. So it's rewarding for me for people to have left that the experience of the movie with us on their minds, because that really wasn't the original intention. But it's, you know, so it's nice. It's nice that people were like, no, I still see you. You are, you know, you and the Clovers and your plight was still central to my viewing enjoyment. Mm-hmm.
Maybe one of my favorite scenes of you in a movie actually is in Two Can Play at That Game. It is your entrance to Big Timers playing as you're pulling the long ponytail. That is an iconic look in Black history.
This moment in Black hair history. Yes, that power
yes.
That power pony with the red suit. Mm-hmm.
Also, I would like to add your appearance in Busta Rhymes' "I Love My Bitch" music video.
Yes.
We can't forget.
Listen, I wanted to be a video host so badly for so many years, but I was never chosen until I kind of already started making it. Bittersweet, but I'm still holding out hope that 3T will reunite and I can star in their video.
There's still time. I mean, gravity and time don't work on you, so
that's why this shit is pulling back. So it's like a snap.
I have one last question before you go. You're known for like your roles, your memoir, your interviews. Yes, I want to ask you about one unexpected thing that you have become known like all over social media for now. You've surely seen the memes from your Oprah interview where you're talking about like your past as like a mean girl before and how you got over it. And when you have the quote, "Did you get the job? Is your house any bigger? Did money magically get put in your pocket?" Mm-hmm. Have you seen that memed to say other things on social media before?
Oh, to say other things other than what I said?
It's like there's specifically one, I think it was like one of like, "Did you get the clown shoes? Did you get in the car?"
No!
or one for even like, "Did you get to go in the house? Did you tap for Massa?" It's changed to say different things in so many other memes.
You know what? I never actually opened, because I can see them like when people tag me, but I just assume I didn't know that they were changing. That's awesome. No, that makes me almost as happy as Grease 2, which is what I was hoping that you would talk about, Ira.
I fully have not gotten over
my lack of an invitation to the Grease 2 party. I don't know if I'll ever get over it, because I didn't know there were Black people who felt as strongly about Grease 2 as I.
I had a Grease themed birthday party. You were there, Lewis.
Oh, yes. I was a cool writer myself. Yes, that's right.
Yeah. And our mutual friend, Kelly Carter, came to the party. I had a photographer there and everything. And then later, she was like, "Gab was so mad that I didn't tell her about this."
I have no one to share. I mean, like, Grease is my all-time favorite movie of all time. Cha-Cha de Gregorio, the best dancer at St. Bernadette's with the worst reputation, is my all-time favorite character of life. But Grease
verbatim, literally
is
verbatim.
Like, there's something about Adrian Zmed and Lorna Left that gives me Beau and Hope vibes. They are relationship goals. Yeah, I just don't think there's enough love that they get.
Maybe that's the one that needs to be remade, not Grease.
Grease 2, like, is it, I mean, who is the Michelle Pfeiffer? Like, who do we cast as the Michelle Pfeiffer?
You look like you're still in high school.
What?
Lewis, has there ever, you would know this of film history, has there truly ever been a remake of just a sequel?
Wow. That's really, you've really worked my brain just now. Like, specifically, like a musical sequel, which is rare as is. No? I mean, yeah. Mamma Mia will be going through iterations for until we're all dead, so who knows?
If you really want to know what I want in a guy, well, I'm looking for a 3 Mamma Mia machine with hell in his eyes. This is my audition. I want a devil in his eye leather. He's gonna be one. I still fight for who gets to be what season with my sisters. You know, for I'll be.
Oh my god.
Yes.
The little things. Union girls.
Next Grease party I have, you will be there.
Ira, I swear to fucking God, I will harm you if I don't get an invite. I want the full sing along.
Dee Dee Khan wigs together.
Yeah.
I mean, and Stalker Channing. I mean, we could bring her back. I think we could lure her out of like semi-retirement.
Stockard will be off book by like noon. Are you kidding me? No. She's ready.
Because there was nothing like a whore hugging her books to her chest, you know? Oh, there were worse things I could do than go with a book. Like, I mean, it's like, if there has ever been like how to shame a girl for a fucking orgasm, than that. I'm just
Well, so many of us walked through high school thinking in ballads, which Rizzo articulated, you know.
I love you guys. I just want to come back every week and talk Grease.
Nobody is objecting. Do it.
Yeah.
No one is objecting.
Come through.
Fourth co-host.
Well, you guys, this has been fun.
Thanks for coming on.
Thank you for being here so much.
Yeah.
All right, people, we all know the stakes of the 2024 election are high, whether it's keeping the Senate, taking back the House, or stopping Republicans at the state level. If you're ready to make a real difference, sign up for Vote Save America's 2024 volunteer program.
And just to make it interesting, we're pitting you against each other. Vote Save America will sort you onto a team, east or west, and you'll compete with a community of other volunteers to maximize your impact on the ground with opportunities tailored to you and the causes you care about.
The team with the highest volunteering staff could secure the biggest prize of all, the continuation of American democracy. Head to votesaveamerica.com/2024 now and get ready to organize or else. This message has been paid for by Vote Save America. You can learn more at votesaveamerica.com, and this ad has not been authorized by any candidate or candidate's committee.
On Monday, rich and famous lawyer and New Yorker contributor and CNN commentator Jeffrey Toobin exposed his penis on a Zoom call with colleagues, leading to Toobin's suspension from one of the nation's most prestigious magazines. And of course, this is entirely unjust, according to some men online.
Yeah, what kind of world is it where your dick can't fall out in a Zoom call? What kind of world is it? Where are we safe?
So basically, he was on a Zoom call with employees of the magazines and WNYC Radio, where they were doing a call prepping for the election, doing like election night coverage. And all of a sudden, like, there's a pause in the call for breakout discussions. And then people see his camera tilted down and his penis is out. When the news was first coming out, like, people were like, oh, was he like going to pee or something? Like, did this accidentally happen? And now it seems that like he had a second video screen open and was jerking off.
Oh, no.
And forgot to turn off the video on the work call that he was on.
A mess.
I just want to say, this is like the worst kind of news story because it has the initial appearance of like nutty stupidity, harmless enough, whatever. And then the more you think about it, it's like, well, did he do it on purpose? I mean, like, based on what you just said, it sounds like he didn't. But like, it's so disgusting and so like, it frankly could be traumatizing that like, it's like, it's hard to just talk about it as like, I want to sit here and make Tuban Japanese puns with everybody, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
But but it's just, it's like, oh no, it's completely horrifying. There's an article on, I believe it's theweek.com, that talks about the myth of the male bumbler and how like, mm-hmm. people get credit for like bumbling into horrible situations. Like the author draws a really good parallel to how Woody Allen handled his horrible allegations and sort of just shrugs them off. You know, I'm a bumbler, et cetera. I recommend people read that.
Just Mr. Magooing yourself.
Yeah.
it also didn't help that on Twitter, what was trending was just Zoom dick. And I was like, oh, does Charlie XCX have a new song out? Like, what is going on? We are doing this. Madonna's out here with a new album.
I truly did not know what was happening for the first wave of the story as well, because I also saw Zoom dick, and I had to look through Twitter search of Zoom dick to find out what people were talking about, because people were just making Zoom dick jokes.
Yeah.
Because at first we didn't know that he was jerking off on the call, you know?
Yeah.
And of course, this has led to awful, awful takes from men. People, you
That's
know,
redundant.
Commenting things like, things like, not sure someone getting caught doing something almost everyone does should be a national story. You know, our propensity to punish and humiliate people with little regard to proportionality is part of the problem. And this has been the takeaway from this. You know, talking about the male bumbler thing that you brought up, Lewis, the idea is that this is something that happens to everybody. And the thing is, no one is implying that everyone doesn't masturbate. What we're saying is that everyone does not do it in the middle of work, particularly when you are on a Zoom with other people working, you know? Like, you're not even at an office, like, fleeing to, like, some bathroom to jerk off in the middle of your workday, right? You are at work on your computer. And I know that with the pandemic, like, the lines have become blurred between, like, what's work and what's home life, right? But you are truly on a
call. Not that home life. Yeah, right.
Right? You are truly on a call. Like, even if they couldn't see you, are you getting your rocks off, jerking off while listening to your coworkers on a call? The fuck is wrong with you?
Well, what frustrates me the most about it is his quote on it is, "I thought I had muted the Zoom video." Do you not understand how video and audio works? You can't mute a video. Look up. Is the green light on, sir? Yes or no? That's your green light. If the green light is on, it's a red light to masturbate. That's all I have to say.
Yeah, the green light, that's like, that makes it tough for me. Like, yeah. It's just out there, very obvious while you're looking at your computer. There's no way to think about it where it makes any sense, where, like, you can relatably write away what had occurred. You're right. Like, mm-hmm. It's too close in proximity to, like, the actual workspace in terms of time.
Yeah.
So it's just frightening.
I wonder if people like that are deliberately just trying to self-sabotage. Like, what? You had to know that this was going to cause problems. And I really refuse to believe that you didn't know you were not being perceived. Like, I just don't. Jeffrey Toobin.
One of the things that is most interesting about the call is the fact that the election simulation that was going on during this call featured Jane Mayer, Masha Gessen, and Dexter Filkins. Mm-hmm. So there are, like, famous, like, people on this call,
yeah.
Right? Like, heavy hitters in New York media. It makes you wonder if this had just happened with, like, subordinates at work, if we would have even found out about it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that he did this and then Jane Mayer's on the call, that's why people know about it, you know?
Yeah.
Like, you think if, like, he had done it and it was just, like, assistants or, like, other, like, entry-level people, no one would have felt comfortable speaking up.
Yeah, they would have accepted that it was an accident without any second thought at all.
Yeah, or even if they didn't accept that it was an accident, it's like, you don't take it, like, public, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so that also brings into play, you know, the concepts of, like, power at play here. And, you know, there were a lot of people trying to compare this to, like, Me Too, which is very silly. But I will say the difference is that the sympathy that is being given to someone like Toobin is very similar to what we hear in, like, a lot of these Me Too situations. You know, it's sort of always the reversing of who the victim is.
Right.
This implication that he is now the victim because he has been publicly shamed and people are making jokes about him and he, you know, can't talk about Supreme Court shit on CNN anymore, and we're losing a vital voice right now when we need him politically. You know, it's implying that he is somehow, you know, being unfairly persecuted because he decided to take out his dick.
Right. And that we're holding ourselves back collectively by holding him to any standard, correct?
Yeah.
Yeah. I think other people will write about the election and we'll be fine. And but we don't need Jeffrey Toobin to be doing so. He can take a little suspension. Also, when you go to look up Jeffrey Toobin, the first thing that's the first suggestion is the actual video. And I just want to know, why are you guys Googling that? Like, what do you want to see? Why are you in pursuit of the Zoom dick?
Also, if you don't want people talking about you like this, you know, like, just don't be jerking off at work. I'm sorry.
Yeah. There is that. Yeah.
You know, like, I get that there's this impetus to, like, protect people from, like, what they see as internet mobs and people, like, making fun of people and shaming them. But, like, this is funny.
Yeah.
You know, without the, like, power structure thing and like forcing people to actually look at your dick, you know, the like the gross part of that, the like almost like assault part of that. The fact of like your dick being on Zoom, like we're allowed to make jokes about it, you know, and you are not protected from being clowned on the internet.
I would also say the situation is so baffling. Like even as you describe it event per event, I still can't picture it. Like I still can't picture like what people saw, like how the conversation did or didn't progress, and apparently they just tried to ignore it for a second. There's a part of me that wants to like purge this vicious cycle of my brain not understanding what had occurred and deal with that maybe online or in a text thread or something. And we should be allowed to have that. But at the same time, right, like don't let that train of thought trick you into sympathizing with him.
Yeah.
Also, I think we've been on Zoom long enough throughout the pandemic to know that like the lighting is just like awful. And so is the camera on MacBooks, you know? It's so much better on your phone. I don't want to see a dick on Zoom in the first place.
Right.
So I'm wondering about the person he was Zoom dicking with.
Right.
You know?
Where's
that person?
Roger Deakins, he better be involved if it's going to be on your computer. Yeah.
What a completely nonsense story. All right, I did mine last week, so before we get to the Keep It segment, Aida, what is your voting plan? We're 2 weeks out from the election.
2 weeks out. Wow, wow, wow. And then Lewis will go, and then we'll have a better president who's a real mortal person, maybe? I hope. But this week, it is my turn to talk about my voting plan. All right, so you guys know I live in California, but I'm registered in Nebraska still. Maybe next year when I'll get things figured out and I'm more permanently here and have an LA ID, I'll be a California voter. But for now, I'm back home. But I had to order an early voting ballot. I ordered that back in September. And I sent it to my new apartment, and it's been what was waiting for me in the mail when I got home. So bada bing, bada boom, I voted. And I wanted to tell you guys I'm excited to vote for Miss Measure 428, who, of course, is not a person, but is a ballot initiative to put much, much needed regulation on loan interest rates, on payday loans, and to limit predatory lending in Nebraska. And if you aren't in Nebraska, still look into like loan sharking policies in your state, because there's a high potential that it goes on there too. Whatever banks deem as like a high risk borrower, those people are being barraged with high interest rates. In Nebraska, it's about 400%. And but those interest rates can go anywhere like upwards of $500. Like it's like Scrooge levels of charging. So yes, I voted for Measure 428 in the state of Nebraska, and that caps percentage loans to 36%, which is a lot more reasonable APRs. Next person I'm excited about voting for is Kate Bolts, who is a member of Nebraska State Senate, and she's representing District 29. She has been in office already since 2013, but her term ends next year, and she's running for higher office. She's running for election to be in the U.S. Senate to represent Nebraska's first congressional district, which has been held by that excuse for a man, Jeff Fortenberry, for quite some time now. Yeah, she's currently a senator, and she's advocated for health benefits for Nebraskans, which is so vital right now during the pandemic and making sure everybody has access to health care. And this would be the first time that we could flip that seat from red to blue since 1964. So this is a really pivotal election for Democrats in Nebraska. But and it's also part of a big push to get more women into higher positions in the Democratic Party. Now, someone I wish I could vote for, because you guys know I'm a Lincoln, Waverly area, so that's the district that I'm in, but there is someone by the name of Kara Eastman who is running for Nebraska's second congressional district, and she has done so much influential work with Omaha Healthy Kids Alliance and making sure that, yes, young kids have access to safe housing and healthy housing in Omaha, which has been a problem because, as we all know, Omaha, for some reason, is just a purely and unabashedly segregated city, and there's a lot of work that needs to be done to make sure that people in marginalized communities are getting access to food and water and housing in Omaha. Eastman and her husband are associate professors at Creighton, which if you're in Nebraska, like I said, this is a Nebraska episode, and they live in Omaha, teach at Creighton University, and have a young daughter as well. Kara Eastman's someone that I would be excited about. I wish I could vote for her. She supports DACA and making dreamers citizens and taxing large corporations who have been getting the one over on us for a little too long. Endorsed by Obama and Biden and Kamala, all the good people. And then just a quick little note. I really wish I could vote for Maya Wiley, who is running in the mayoral race in New York City right now. She's never held elected office, and she's a professor and activist who is trying to come up after Bill de Blasio. So hopefully there'll be a more equitable New York City, and hopefully there'll be a more equitable Nebraska. So that's my voting plan.
Well, thank you, Aida. And just so y'all know, there are less than 13 days left to vote, but you don't have to wait until then to get your vote in. There are plenty of options to vote early and safely. Visit votesaveamerica.com/plan to make your plan and your voting location and vote as soon as you can. And tell all your family and friends to do the same.
Yes. And also you can track your ballot at iwillvote.com/NE for Nebraska or whatever your state regulations are. Like, you can track it like it's a Domino's pizza. You have no excuse to not see where it's at.
We've made it easier than ever to find remote and in-person volunteer opportunities with Vote Save America's new volunteer hub at votesaveamerica.com/volunteer. There you can find everything from your usual phone and text banks to roles delivering yard signs or staffing voter protection hotlines. Go to votesaveamerica.com/volunteer to find all your options to get involved between now and Election Day. My God, it's so soon.
When we're back, keep it. And we're back with our favorite segment of the episode. As usual, it is Keep It. I feel like we've got a lot of things to keep this week.
True.
What's on your mind, boys?
Well, why don't we get this out of the way? I feel like we all have a collective Keep It to Miss Tiffany Trump.
who, like Melania, unfortunately had cultivated a bit of intrigue over the years. Like, what do we know about this person? It can't be, is she here to save us? The bullshit, we thought. And now this video has surfaced. Didn't gain a lot of traction as far as the beginning of the week went. And it happened on Friday. She spoke at a quote-unquote Trump Pride event in Tampa, where she came out to I Got a Feeling by the Black Eyed Peas, which...
yeah. Popular song in this year, because it's a 2020 song.
I mean, you may as well put on Casey and the Sunshine Band. What? Whose pride is that? And she came out and did like an even dirtier version of the Ron Reagan Jr. thing, where she's like, well,
oh, yeah.
I know my dad, and you know, he understands the LGBTIAQ community. She sort of stumbles through it in a voice that can only be described as Miley Cyrus-esque. There are questions of, did she leave the tea out on purpose? Based on the presentation she was giving, I'm not sure she was purposely doing anything.
She was trying to say CIA, which is the craziest part about this whole story. Yeah, I don't know. Maybe like the children's book that were read to her were alphabet books that had 28 pages.
Right.
I don't understand like what synapses were not firing when she was giving this speech.
I think it's just a beautiful coda to what always happens with these silly, superfluous white women that gay men will sometimes try to stand on the internet. You know, like the whole thing about Tiffany Trump, as you were saying, Lewis, was the fact that like, she was never really brought up in the same way that Ivanka or Don Jr. or even that claymation
Eric
is brought up. And, you know, so it was always like, oh, she's the forgotten daughter. There were always jokes that, like, Trump doesn't even know her name. And it used to be like, she's the one who's going to bring down the Trump empire, right? And, like, she had released a song years ago, Like a Bird.
Like a Bird, yes.
Yes, and so people would always reference that song or be like, when is Like a Bird gonna chart on Billboard? Like, jokes like that, right? And then here she comes, and she's just as miserable and disgusting as the rest of her family.
Right.
Shocker.
Wow.
Which we saw weeks ago, because she trotted herself out at the RNC to defend her father.
Mm-hmm. I feel like now there was a race. There was a race in my mind of who was the dumbest child, and it was Eric Trump for the longest time, because even last month, we know that Eric accidentally said that he was part of the LGBTQ community when he said,
right.
I am a part of that community. So they're both just like, I don't know. They want what we got. They want what we got.
And he's also married to Lara Trump, who goes on CNN and tries to stutter her way out of making fun of Joe Biden's stutter, which was fascinating to watch if you haven't seen that interview. But yeah, also, truly, even though there may be some mystery gay out there who gets like some irony laugh out of calling Tiffany Trump like our potential savior, there is no gay person, even in Tampa, where I've never been, and I'm sure they're lovely there, who could possibly mistake Tiffany Trump for being an actual ambassador to the LGBT community. It is a pathetic stunt on her part.
Who was there? The room looked like it had 12 people in it, and I'm not even sure any of them were gay.
I mean, like, this is still the man who had the people paid for to watch him descend on an escalator and into our goddamn lives, so you never know.
That is like whenever you see Blacks for Trump's photos, they're white people wearing Blacks for Trump shirt.
Right.
I don't think any of these people were actually gay. They paid some college students, probably from Talking Point USA, to hustle over to some little convention center and listen to her just stumble her way through this speech.
You know? Location, and they put a shower curtain up in a 7-Eleven and we're like, this is it. Lesbians by the Twinkies.
Bonnie McKee literally performing in a 7-Eleven parking lot.
That's oh, callback to American Girl. Love that song. Do not let Tiffany near that song. She will claim it. Yeah.
It was probably originally written for Tiffany after Like a Bird, but then when Like a Bird flopped, Bonnie was like, I'll sing it myself.
Mm-hmm.
Also, you brought him up. Keep it to that bitch, Ronald Reagan. Son.
Yeah, don't fucking tell me anything about your dad. Don't tell me anything about him. No.
In case any of you missed, like, he comes out in an interview talking about my father would be disgusted with the way that, like, Trump is just basically desecrating the Oval Office. It's like, no, he wouldn't. Your father is the reason we're in this fucking mess. He lit the fucking match. He started the fire. Billy Joel knows it. We know it.
Nobody could suck worse than Reagan, except, of course, our current president and nobody else. So there you go. Formal keep it's this week. I just want to say that I have a keep it I wanted to abort, as in it's not going to be my keep it. I was initially going to say keep it to the supermarket sweep on ABC with Leslie Jones. When it started off, I'm like, oh, it's not as good as the original. And the lighting is too, get ready, horny. The supermarket is like lit like you're in, as my friend Mandel noted, a Virgin Airlines flight. And that's not how supermarkets look. I was mad.
I miss Virgin.
I know. And then I watched two episodes. It is actually really good. And I think Leslie Jones, it's the best work I've ever seen her do. Like, she's suited for it and her excitement makes sense. I will say that my actual keep it this week is to a movie that apparently Ira likes, The Trial of the Chicago 7, which is getting good reviews. Here's my problem. Well, I'll name the good things first. Sacha Baron Cohen, excellent.
Yes.
Love him as an actor. And Borat and Bruno are like so not really my brand comedy ways that I forget that I'm a fan of his. He's like a brilliant person, mm-hmm. Went to Cambridge, you know.
He was the best part of Sweeney Todd.
Sweeney Todd, right? We put him in Hugo. Sorry about that.
Yeah.
And also the great Mark Rylance is fabulous too. Unfortunately, Aaron Sorkin is someone kind of like Woody Allen to me, where regardless if the material is good or bad, you are so used to how one character will get a monologue and he'll be up against some total rube or some total scold. And the good and bad guys to me are uninteresting in that dichotomy. And that is what happens in this movie. It feels like a radio play, which a lot of people will like, I think. But it just feels like less than a movie to me. And my God, the lighting. Turn on a light in that courtroom. My Jesus, I couldn't see shit.
You needed the Virgin Airlines lighter.
That's what I'm saying, right. Yeah, horn me up. Yeah.
So I watched The Trial of the Chicago 7 last night, mostly in spite of Eddie Redmayne being in it, and mostly for Love of my life, Jeremy Strong being in it, who
not
I
into
think
that performance
hilarious.
Either. Not into that.
Really? No. It's. I thought he was great.
I thought it was very Funny or Die.
I loved him and Sasha just basically as this like modern version of Pineapple Express operating through this Sorkin movie. But what I like about The Trial of Chicago 7 is that it plays to Aaron Sorkin's strengths. He loves a speech. He loves, you know, someone getting indignant for the truth and justice, you know, and he really loves the government for some reason. You know, he thinks that, like, at its best level, the government is the most beautiful thing to ever exist. This movie works in that respect for me because it's basically about people giving speeches, you know, like he's originally a playwright. He did that with A Few Good Men. And it takes him back to his roots of like, here is a setting where it makes sense for people just to be talking all the fucking time, you know? And I think that those ticks work for me because at his core, Aaron Sorkin is really just writing straight males who need recognition and to be loved by other straight men.
Right. Which does put me, an anger in me. I just want to say that. Go ahead. Yeah.
I feel like I like that because you and I talk all about one of the only interesting parts of the Oscars really is paying attention to the best actress and supporting actress wins because the roles that men are usually nominated for are like overwrought and like the annoying kind of shit like Gary Oldman in The Darkest Hour or, you know, like a performance I actually like, but, you know, like a Casey Affleck in Manchester by the Sea. It's usually those kind of performances, right? Like women at least get like fun, dramatic performances that like are quotable, you know, like a Blue Jasmine, you know, or like a Viola in Fences, you know, like they feel like they are actual like fun characters that you want to watch. And if there's one thing I can say about Aaron Sorkin is that he is obsessed with writing straight male characters, but he usually at least has the wherewithal to make them interesting. Any of the male characters in any Aaron Sorkin film like feel like a revelation compared to most of the male characters that I feel like Hollywood wants us to like.
I will say that I think Andrew Garfield remains the snub of the 2010s in The Social Network. That was really a fabulous performance. And then he got nominated for Hacksaw Ridge of all things, which I think is actually crueler than not nominating him. So
I think that for his weird tics and sometimes writing women horribly, Aaron Sorkin has, you know, a bit of a feminine or melodramatic touch when it comes to writing, you know, softer male relationships. And I just wish we saw that on screen more. It's telling that Andrew Garfield was snubbed for Social Network and then is rewarded for being in a fucking Mel Gibson film, right? It shows what the industry respects.
On that, I can agree with you about Aaron Sorkin, but I won't go any further in this Molly's game you've set up for me.
Molly's game is a lot like The Trial of Chicago 7, too. I think it would be better if Aaron Sorkin didn't direct it. I think he's not a director.
Right. The direction was very traditional, I thought, but
yeah, unfortunately, the script is better than the direction, just like Molly's game.
Aida, what do you think keep it to?
Wow. So there are six men who have just been taken into custody because they were caught to have been devising a plot to kidnap Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer.
The Michigan Six.
Yeah, the Michigan Six, the trial of the Michigan Six. And, you know, this is already a ludicrous story, but all the news articles are like, you know, reporting on this as a kidnapping of Gretchen Whitmer. And I'm like, she's a fucking governor. Like, at what point can we just call it a napping? we have to draw the lines, guys. And that's not what makes me most mad. So these guys, okay, these, you know, just imagine like six men in tactical gear with no girlfriends and a lot of guns and a lot of free time to have group chats where they talk about kidnapping governors. So the people that are being, they're being investigated because they stalked her. They scribbled out these little maps. They posted a lot of videos of them in tactical wear with guns, like ready to execute this plan. They're domestic terrorists is what I'm trying to say. And okay, yeah, they are kidnapping. Cool, I get it. More importantly, I'm mad about the execution. You drew maps. They drew maps. They made a plan to catch her, deliver her to proper authorities, and then have her tried for treason. This is, what kind of 1950s ass crimes are you guys committing? Like a kidnapping plot, treason? You organized a plot? Like, are you a boxcar child? Like, what is this? If you don't just vandalize that woman's front door and go about your day, like, go find another way to terrorize her. And I don't want to be this reductive and this dangerous, but, like, are Proud Boys just guys without hobbies? Because, like, baby, I will show you the way. I can get you a Nintendo Switch. I can get you a puzzle. I can get you something to do. You can play Animal Crossing.
And no imagination. No imagination.
At
we
all.
We just talked to Gabrielle Union about Days of Our Lives. You know what? I would like to be Stefano DiMera kidnapping Hope Brady or Marlena Evans. Like, when I eventually kidnap Charlie Puth, it will be to hold him in a cage underneath a Parisian sewer until he falls in love with me.
Right. And that will have a narrative. That will have a beginning, middle, end, a story, a conflict.
Thank
this
you.
This had nothing. This had absolutely nothing. Like, and I just play a game. Play Animal Crossing. Don't play human endangerment. That's just something to do. And of course, Trump adds fuel to this bullshit fire by harassing her about what happened. Because Trump doesn't actually have thoughts about women. Trump sees a woman and his eyes roll back and he goes into a fugue state. And every thought input comes out as the vocal output, lock her up. Like, that's it. He doesn't have real ideas about them. And so Gretchen went on, it was like Fox or CNN, of course. She just went on a news channel, and she had a little glass, like, paperweight in the background that said 8645. Now, any logical person would have read that and been like, oh, she's talking about how we would much rather have Joe Biden, the logical, humane option, as our president, instead of 45, Trump, because we refuse to call him by his name. But Trump's campaign goes on to say, wow, Governor Gretchen Whitmer is encouraging assassination attempts on Trump because 86 is clearly a word that implies getting rid of and therefore death. So just, you know, I know we didn't need to hear it, that everyone on his campaign, everyone on his team is a fucking idiot, but it's fun and it's amusing. But keep it to Trump. Keep it to these six men who think that they're in the Italian job. I just go again, find a hobby.
Also, by the way, well, first of all, the words Proud Boys, I mean, they're just proud of being themselves. So that literally means there's no activity involved. So we'll just say that, one. And then two, 86 is literally diner slang.
Exactly.
So stop pretending it means like, oh, buy a harpoon and use it on fucking Donald Trump or whatever.
If she really wanted to get rid of Trump, it would have said 18745, okay?
Exactly. Also, another thing is I always want to say Gretchen Wieners when I try and say Gretchen Wieners.
I know, yeah.
So I say Gretchen Wieners and I'm like, I guess nobody could make fetch happen. Just like worked a little too well with the kidnapping plot.
Gretchen Wieners, we should just lock her up.
Lock her up. Speaking of mean girls. So that's my keep it. Okay. Ira, what is your keep it this week?
My keep it this week is to several black men.
Mm-hmm.
All of them rich.
A gaggle of them.
a gaggle of Negroes. A gaggle of niggas. Not just Kanye, who we've been exhausted talking about, but 50 Cent, Ice Cube, Diddy, all of them who are now coming out either pro-Trump or in direct opposition to the Democratic Party because they are rich and basically don't want to pay taxes.
Again, just bored men. Bored men. We had the Proud Boys, now we have the Bad Boys. Like, just bored fucking men.
Let me get into the first one. 50 Cent was posting on Instagram after discovering Joe Biden's tax plan of, you know, taxing the wealthy. And it's like, oh, I don't even care that Trump don't like black people. I want to vote for him. Fuck Joe Biden, basically, because he wants to keep his money. You know, he sold quarter water to Coca-Cola. He would like women who have a baby by him to still be a millionaire, you know. And he can only give them, you know, a Popeye's gift certificate if Biden taxes him.
Curtis, yeah.
Fuck you, Curtis.
Brilliant, brilliant. This I've never heard this point of view before. I'm so glad he articulated it for us. Yeah. Oh, you'd like more fucking money and you're incredibly rich.
It's like, it's insinuated that if you are a celebrity, you are a covert Republican now. If you're going to be like that, that's just a level of stupidity that I can't deal with at all.
Right. And then there's Ice Cube, who is talking to Trump about black issues, apparently, saying that he had a talk with the Biden campaign and that he had a talk with the Trump campaign, and the Trump campaign, you know, decided that they would support his issues or whatever. I don't know. I really haven't paid too much attention to the actual Ice Cube of it all, because I still remember when he was on his anti-Semitic rant like a few months ago.
Is it like a Nick Cannon-esque type of feel? Is it like the black liberation, black first, forward thinking? Okay, Marcus Garvey.
Yes, Marcus Garvey. The Jews are holding the blacks back, thinking. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes. And then Diddy is teaming up with this group called like Our Black Party, which is about...
Whose black party?
You know, our black party. Ours, Aida. And it is
the one me and you are.
So
part of.
They were very like mysteriously like not talking about whether or not they were a PAC or like a third political party, like set up to, you know, like take votes away from Biden, because they were announced like 2 weeks before the election ends. You know, we're in the midst of an election. Can't say it's starting in 2 weeks. It ends in 2 weeks. But they went on Instagram Live recently. Diddy was on Instagram Live with two people from Our Black Party, only Diddy's screen was completely blank. And the only two people speaking were this woman, Candace Hollingsworth. She's the mayor of Hyattsville. And someone named Dr. Wes Bellamy. And the nonsense that I was hearing, you can be a Democrat, you can be a Republican, as long as you put black first. I don't know what the fuck that means. Because you certainly cannot be a Republican and be putting black first. Period. And to answer the questions about whether they're a PAC or a political party, we're operating as a PAC but can move wherever the culture needs us to. And they really want to just raise money to support black interests and black candidates and whatever. This sounds like embezzlement.
Embezzle. This also just reaffirms the fact that the only Bellamy worth listening to is Bill. And that's it. That's literally it.
Cousin Skeeter, Saint Skeeter.
Yeah. And Bellamy Young from Scandal.
Oh, okay, yes. Fine. She was great on Celebrity Jeopardy, actually. Look it up.
But wow. I mean, we talked about this with Gabrielle, right? You know, just this idea that niggas get some money and now all of a sudden it's like, fuck everybody else.
Yeah.
You know? And like, you should have seen it coming, because many of these people disrespected black women. You know, Ice Cube, historically abusive to black women. Mm-hmm. You know, 50 Cent, disgusting to black women. And homophobic to boot.
Yeah.
Diddy didn't give Cassie that ring. So fuck him.
Made all those girls go get that cheesecake. Come on. Trade the cheesecake.
Okay?
No.
Made people walk to Brooklyn to pick up cheesecake for him on Making the Band.
Right.
I know we all remember
juniors,
that.
At Junior's.
Okay.
I want that.
Truly disrespected Danity Kane.
He also disrespected Kashmir by Led Zeppelin. That fucking Godzilla song is a no. Sorry.
So we should have seen it coming, right? You know, it should have looked familiar to us.
Yeah.
It is truly just a different side of disgusting seeing like black men who started like on the fucking bottom of society rapping about police brutality, rapping about you know, like the political disadvantages that come to being black in America, and now they got some coins and they're like, fuck everybody else, you know. It's disappointing. It's not surprising, but it's still disappointing that you can't trust niggas with money.
You can't. Let me remind you, Andre fired you. And I wish that never lit a fire under your ass, Diddy. I wish you had never got a hustle mentality, because look at where we're at now.
It's a shame, you know?
It is. Yeah, it sucks. Don't want to hear it.
Straight black men, the weak link. Stay the weak link. That was a hell of a keeper segment this week, baby.
Well, got heated.
We made up for listing 150 things that we liked last week.
Right.
Yeah.
And we got all the compliments we wanted about how we finally had positive energy. Well, that's over now.
Yeah, I know. Yes. I had way too many DMs. Like, I don't want to invite y'all's kindness into my life right now. No.
Taxing.
I am still purely distaste. I am purely contempt. That's
speaking of taxes, that's what's taxing to me. Yeah.
Ooh, I love a good word joke.
I want to thank Gabrielle Union for joining us this week. It was an honor to finally have her on the show.
In fact, everybody should thank her. She fucking ruled. Yeah.
One of the best people to interview, easily. Just such a lighthearted person.
Love it when a guest sings. And we will see you next week. Keep It is a production of Crooked Media. Caroline Reston is our producer. Our editor is Bill Lance, and Kyle Seglin is our sound engineer. Our digital team is Nadine Melkonian and Milo Kent. Thank you to Brian Sebel for production support every week.